Why does the Lord promise never again to destroy the earth with a flood, but then comes up with an alternative method? Welcome to Probe. We continue our discussions of beginnings and belongings based on the book of Genesis. My conversation partners are again Paul Dibdall and Larry Vavirka from the Walla Walla College School of Theology. That's the question I'd like to toss back to you. Why do we have this almost blank check? God says, I got unhappy with human beings once, but will not happen again. How do you explain that? Because the rest of Scripture points out that there's destruction coming.
Well, there is destruction, but is it on as grand a scale? Does it involve all living creatures? Because, again, the promise, I don't want to be too picky here, but the words are, never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. Is it in the same manner? And certainly in the final destruction, it is not that all of humanity is wiped out. So maybe I'm just nitpicking here. But
well, we have two destructions coming, one at the second coming, which in the language of Revelation repeats the Genesis 1, the Septuagint in Greek repeats the Hebrew words of Genesis 1, reducing the earth to elemental chaos, essentially. That's pretty devastating. Then there's the final destruction that precedes, and the cleansing of the earth by fire that precedes the recreation of the earth. These are different forms, and these are purification, and these seem to have a different purpose. There are differences.
But can we get inside the divine psychology here that seems to be really touched by what's happened and said, I won't do this again? That's the question I have. And maybe there's not a good answer for it, but I thought I would see if I could explore your minds with that question.
I've always understood the final destruction of the wicked as a kind of consequence that happens when Jesus is coronated and appears before the whole human family as he is. No shrouding of his divinity. He appears in his glory. His glory is his love, his goodness for his people. It is the light, the warmth, the goodness of their existence. Mm-hmm. For those who have persistently and consistently rejected him, for them it is as a consuming fire. And that seems to be more a consequence of a natural order of events. It's different from the intentional destruction that God wreaks upon the earth at the time of the flood. It's a very different kind of scene to me.
There is the sense, then, in which God, well, it's quite clear in Scripture that none of us can survive in God's presence in our sinful state. And when there are exceptions to that, it is really quite, Scripture marks them as exceptions. For example, Jacob comes away from his experience. We'll be looking at that in weeks ahead. I've seen God face to face, and I am still alive. So there is a sense that only the pure in heart will be able to see God. And when the final analysis comes, there will be no more miracles on God's part to protect the wicked. At that point, there will be simply self-destruction. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's take another question that comes up here in this early post-flood world. It is the sanctity of life. And this is kind of a troubling quote, but let's take a look at it. God gives the people now the opportunity to eat animal food. But he says, for your own lifeblood, I will surely require a reckoning from every animal I required and from human beings, each one for the blood of another. I will require a reckoning for human life. Whoever sheds the blood of a human, by a human shall that person's blood be shed. For in his own image God made humankind. And you be fruitful and multiply, abound on the earth, and multiply in it. This is a fairly stark command here. against taking human life, as if the exception granted to Cain will no longer be possible. Is that the way to read that passage? Now, I think we'd want to be careful about applying that too rigorously, because you think of David, for example, who killed Uriah, and he was not put to death. You don't have very many examples in the Bible where you have immediate punishment that is directly attributable to a person's wickedness. You have many more examples where people got away with murder, so to speak. So do we have any way of is this simply rhetoric, which simply says that which happened at the time of the flood will not happen again, and if you do, you'll pay a stiff price for it?
Maybe so. And it does seem to be speaking about, maybe not. Maybe I'm trying to put more in there than is there, but a certain kind of taking of life. And I think there are distinctions which are clearly mm-hmm. made in the Old Testament that, there's taking a life and then there's taking a life. They're not all.
And in fact, the cities of refuge seems right. to make is the clearest distinction between that, the life that's yes. taken accidentally as over against the one that's taken.
And the life in battle or the life taken in defense as opposed right. to a, mm-hmm. a court sort of mm-hmm. murder or homicide.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another question raised here. And this is an intriguing one, Paul, because you, as you mentioned in an earlier discussion, you named your son Noah. Noah was a good man, mm-hmm. but also a flawed man. Mm-hmm. He made a serious mistake here after the flood, led his son to mock him, which then resulted in a curse on his son. What does that tell us about grace and the relationship of goodness to grace? Can we address that just a little bit here? Because here you have a man that God used, but a man who is still a flawed instrument.
Yeah. And not just Noah, I would point out. There are some people who are named David, for example, and
Abraham.
Abraham. Not as many Abrahams today, but yes. I think anyone that we would pick out in Scripture, the same thing could be said of them.
Yeah.
And it just speaks of God's goodness and God's patience in the way that he deals with flawed human beings. Mm-hmm. He uses people and blesses people and protects people who are far from perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And Noah's yet another example of that, seems like mm-hmm. to me.
Larry, do you have any insights from your work in pastoral counseling on the role of strong threats, the role of good life, the role of mercy, grace, all of those things mixed together in terms of how God recovers people and helps them to recover?
I think that the most effective way, of course, is the way of loving someone as opposed to scaring the wits out of them. The use of fear as a motivator is good in the short run, but it doesn't tend to promote the kind of lasting change mm-hmm. that is sustained by love and mutual respect and those particular qualities. And I wonder, it seems to be a mix, and I wonder to what extent people are reading their own experience into the consequences that they see or experience with God, and fear becomes a part of the equation to understanding the sort of steadfast and unfailing consistency of love that somehow seems to be the overriding mm-hmm. Characteristic of God in his dealings with human beings.
Well, there is a sense in which God's grace is terribly unfair. I think it's safe to say that sin is terribly unfair because it touches innocent lives. But God's grace is also terribly unfair. And we'll see this when we come to the story of Abraham. He tells lies, and who gets punished? The people he tells the lies to. See? So if you're going to have a gracious God, there will be some loose ends, and we need to be able to deal with that. Now I'd like to go on to an important transition here. The world has been cleansed, but in many ways is very problematic. The marks of sin are still very much there. But there's a verse here which I have found astonishing, and I'd like to kind of put it in here as the capstone to this catastrophic series of events that we see in Genesis 3 to 11. It's Joshua 24:2, where Joshua is reviewing the history of Israel's people, and as it comes down to Abraham, the last line there it says, "And they served other gods." So by the time we get to the story of Abraham, and that's the next event that comes here in Genesis, you have a catastrophic loss of the knowledge of God. And what I'd like for us to take just a few moments to talk about here is the contrary impulse for many believers is to emphasize the continuity. Once true, always true, truth passed down, and yet here in Abraham's experience, leading up to Abraham's experience, you have this amazing demonstration that whatever knowledge God had given to his people had simply disappeared. Any comments on how that might shape our interpretation of the biblical account? Abraham, who knew very little about God, rather than Abraham, knew everything which God had given to the ancestors before him. Any comments on that that would help us as we interpret Scripture?
No.
You could tempt me. Maybe a reason I asked the question there is because I think that the only way to explain the kinds of things that happened in Abraham's life are a result of this catastrophic loss of God. And if we tie it in with some of the things we've said before about freedom of choice, you start where people are. And you meet them where they are. But it is, I found it really quite striking, the impulse I see again and again in my students to want to say that all the truths that were given to Adam and Eve in the garden were passed along faithfully from generation to generation. And yet when you actually read the stories, there is a catastrophic loss of the knowledge of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that these first chapters of Genesis just, I think, illustrate that time and again. With some of the examples we've talked about through the weeks.
Yeah. And in fact, if you were to chart that, every major event from Genesis 3 to 11, while there are tinges of grace, to be sure, it's one piece of bad news after another. Adam and Eve in the garden, then you have Cain murdering Abel, then you have Lamech's violence, and you have the flood, the Tower of Babel, we haven't even talked about that one, and then finally you come to Abraham, and that's the story that we're going to pick up next week. So, my thanks to Paul and Larry for their conversation assistance. My thanks to Susan Michael for our program engineer. And to all of you for listening. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.